Welcome to the Long Coat Mafia Podcast. Sit back, relax, and enjoy your program.
More people coming in. We have a pretty full program this evening. The first part of our program is going to be our spoken word. This evening around 7 o'clock, Mr. Edwin Ramirez is scheduled to play some drums with us this evening. So we've had some changes from our flyers, but we're here to have fun this evening. We've called this program the Boys Club. This is our fourth program that we've managed to put together here at Good Natured this year. Our first program was with Earl Harrison, Blue Collar Jedi, which was pretty amazing. Our second program featured Ed Zionizer and his group from Scheherazade. And from that second reading, we have Steve Altman back this evening, which will be a lot of fun. And we have Mr. Mike Grady this evening doing some spoken word. And Mr. Grady helped us out with the chocolate festival that we did in downtown Martinsburg, West Virginia, earlier this year. Guys and Dolls went really well, and I think that we're going to have a lot of fun with Boys Club. So Mr. Ed Zionizer said that he would want to come up and read some of his work to kind of open this evening. Are you ready, Mr. Zionizer? My good friend, Ed Zionizer. Give him a round of applause, everybody.
Well, Wilbur, I'm more used to being called Mr. Ed. Treatment plan. Does that sound okay? Doesn't sound like it's on. Is there any more sound coming out now?
Testing.
That's beginning to sound like sound. Thank you. Treatment plan. She had postpartum depression after her MFA. Her Rice Krispies quit speaking to her. Her imagination hid in a whole arm oven mitt. She wondered how the hell Joyce Carol Oates does it. She thought she smelled Neruda's Ode to My Socks. All her dreams involved out-of-state license plates. Maybe kissing that trumpet player spoiled her. Her dogs, Pee-wee and Calcium, turned up incontinent. The trumpet player wore a rug. Her dogs peed on it. No more duct tape solutions. Researchers find that some things can survive black holes, like high fructose corn syrup, Red Bull energy drink, mint flavored snuff, textured vegetable protein, artisanal pop tarts, cheese puffs, tomato aspic, gourmet teriyaki beef sticks, Ford Edsels, Studebaker Avantes, MTV reruns, cinch belts, crinolines, bombers with clips, executive sandboxes, Fox News, spent nuclear fuel, American exceptionalism, tanning beds, tofurkey, genital herpes, 17-year locust sleeping it off, and cockroaches, also euphemistically called very large water bugs, not to mention Texas winged cockroaches who fly out open windows to wait out pesticides or other lapses of our interspecific hospitality. Plagued by baby gray squirrels invading her house, our town's poet laureate pulled the statue of St. Francis out of her backyard and replaced it with a figurine of Dick Cheney made before he had the heart transplant. Persistence of the...
That was good!
Sorry.
Persistence of the parent tapes. Don't stick beans up your nose, my father told me from his practical side, although mostly he advised things like thesis, antithesis, synthesis, and to stick only to religious groups that demonstrate, quote, the dignity of effort, all others being apostate, driving me to the dictionary again and again, where I got distracted by words about bodily functions or almost anything that ends with the suffix ology. Hence my first book, a list really, titled One Suffix, while I worked up my nerve for the second book, My Nose, a Partial Autobiography with No Beans, after which my third book seemed to write itself. I can't make up my mind about Heisenberg, a book about argument, although mostly a memoir of siblings. Quote, yes it is, no it isn't, and it is and it isn't. After which I'd largely written my father out of my angst, although curiously, while driving to the publication party for that book, I tried taking an aspirin with no liquid, then sneezed, and moments later my upper nasal passages began to burn, making my eyes water so much I had to stop to blow my nose, and you can guess, there was that partially dissolved aspirin clot looking for all the world like a navy bean. Ladies and gentlemen, you don't want a poet as significant other. Poets wear a bare path inside the fence. Open the gate, they're so at a loss they lie down and nap till you let them back in. They ace the 100-yard dash like on steroids, but the quarter mile, they lie down and nap to wait out the starter for the next short dash. On a short, short leash, they'll consider a walk, then, intent as hedge fund hawkers snorting coke, go hydrant to hydrant, sniff out great lines. They're loyal to a fault, but their alpha isn't you. It's a long-dead Greek whose name means memory. She has seven daughters they named the museums for. That your poet's tongue hangs out should not be read as a pheronomic parable of urgent desire directed toward you, but it rather signifies a simple vagary of respiration, a paradox of thin skin sensitivity coupled with the hair shirt's thick skin sloughing off of distraction. Read you and your needs and wants. Do you own a pickup truck? Your poet won't ride in the cab with you, but stand in the truck bed, nose to the fastest waves of wind wafting past the cab with news of the immediate future that just might launch or anchor or clinch the next poem. And on Valentine's Day, expect maybe a bone, possibly of contention, but maybe tough leather as a mere metaphor. Changing of the guard dogs. Late in life, the billionaire Howard Hughes started saving his turds, maybe thinking about his authorized biography in DNA or imagining dietitians for China's last emperor sniff his turds to fine-tune the royal diet. Just think how far Hughes had soared above the Wright brothers' breakthrough airy dream. How can dogs not now start to think of their masters as staff instead, as cats have done since Egypt implanted their genetic memory of godhood? Surely it will take but a few more generations of dogs being followed by leash-holding humans, armed with plastic bags to collect their turds, then once back home to store them in huge cans, some plastic, with wheels. Can canine pack minds whose synapses fire mostly over nasal data not soon think themselves Howard Hughes's as they amble about the hood to take care of business in this winding down of our age of self-esteem? Thank you. That clapping kind of wakes you up. watching The Bachelorette with my wife for 40 plus years. Let's go to Iceland, I tell my wife. Rent a helicopter to fly over a glacier and set down beside an active volcano. Rent mini horses for a ride in the outback. Then swim in the geothermal blue lagoon, sipping chilled champagne in stemmed glasses. You mean, after we do California and New York, where we tightrope walk between skyscrapers, she asked. Our first few dates were more mundane than the bachelorettes, with their bevy of stud muffins trolling for who knows what, with pheromones on treble hooks for bait between 12 streaks of commercials and the pregnant pauses that pass for drama, or pass the Dramamine, please. I'd rather that than a rose, if you don't mind. When it comes down to spouting empty formulas, I gave at the office. Three or four shows away from the finale for Ally, everyone admits how they're, quote, beginning to develop feelings, quote, as love's passion comes on slowly with the half-life of uranium and maybe affects your thyroid before your emotions, or if it's old-fashioned, your gonads, which don't come into play on The Bachelorette until we're down to the final three or so bachelors or divorcees, if you listen to the neo-tabloids, three-timers with two loves back home who the producers stuck in to pump up the ratings, but don't tell Ally until the episode airs on TV first. Thank you.
Thank you, Ed. It's always fun having you up on this stage. Our next performer is going to be Mr. Altman, Mr. Steve Altman. Want to come up and do some time for us, please? Have a lot of fun. Steve Altman, everybody.
I'm not sure, but Mr. Keegan hasn't showed up yet. Keegan Abernathy.
Keegan Abernathy?
No.
No Keegan? We don't have Mr. Keegan Abernathy yet.
I'll talk till he gets here.
Okay. Good evening.
As far as I can tell, one, two, three.
As far as I can tell,
one, two, three, four people have heard this stuff or part of this before. Is that Keegan? Come on up, Keegan. Keegan Abernathy.
You talk about getting thrown into the heat around here.
All right, hello everyone.
Do you want a couple of minutes to get ready? I mean, a few minutes to sit down.
It'd be cool to sit down for a second.
You're going
to
sit down.
Can I see this bag over here? All right. I decided that for some reason Boys Club got dumped on me to facilitate. So if this doesn't go perfectly, I apologize. Most of you guys know me, and you know that I'm not a perfect person. So, you know, we're going to get through this.
Thanks,
John. Most of you guys know me in this blue-collar context. You know me as a local guy, fairly reclusive. I believe only Miss Conrad in the back and some very few limited friends have even seen my portfolio of artwork. I am an artist. I've done quite a bit in my life. I've seen my name in the Washington Post three times, 2001, 2003, and again in 2007. Not a small accomplishment for an artist from Martinsburg, West Virginia. Actually, I was born in Jefferson County. But not a small thing to do. And with one of those reviews, I got a mixed review. So I sent the art critic of the Washington Post, Michael O'Sullivan, a blow-up sex doll for Christmas to the Washington Post. He has remembered my name to this very day. And I'm hoping that after this introduction to Don Diego Ramirez, that everyone here will remember my name. So I thought my first question, what is an antique? How old does something have to be an antique? 10 years, 15 years, 20 years, 30 years. Let's go
27 years. I'm going to take you guys back to 1987. That would make the things in this bag an antique, right? 1987, that's a long time ago. We're all comfortable with that, nearly 30 years. Guys, I want to see my antiques. I want to show you my antique. But based on the reaction to the two antiques in this bag, that'll dictate whether or not I show anyone the antiques that remain in the second bag. Now, 1987. Calvin, I don't even think you were born yet. How many people even remember 87? Can I see your hand? Mr. Grady, I knew you would remember 1987.
Stop calling me Mr. Grady.
Mike. Now, do you remember your youth fondly, Mike? Yes or no?
For the most part.
Yeah, me too. So these two items I brought to share with the group to do a little show and tell are from 1987. Nearly 30 years ago. Are connected to a much larger story in the bag. So by a show of hands, do I quit now and sneak out the door?
Quit now.
Mr. Altman, I knew for sure I was going to get that from you, Mr. Altman. I knew it. But you just remember, I'm killing time. I'm just killing time. Can't do it. Show of hands. Go on or stop. Are you so easily offended by two simple props from 1987 that I should stop now?
Yes.
Okay.
No.
No. Go on?
Yeah.
Okay, let's go on for a little bit longer. I'd like to show two photographs that I'll pass around to the group. And I'll start my little backstory, and then I'll do my conclusion. Now, this is the fashion that I have today, my blue-collar fashion that most people know. But in 1987, at the age of 21, I thought myself to be quite the fashionista. So I'm going to start one in this side of the room. We'll pass them around. Now, both of these two black and white photographs from 1987 were done in the fall semester at then Shepherd College as part of my drawing one class and my drawing two class. Both of the two portraits became life-size drawings. The one in the bondage photograph, which again, 1987, the ball gag and the leather mask. Pulp Fiction comes out in 1994. So, you know, I'm a little bit ahead of even Quentin Tarantino for that period. So is everyone getting a good look at the style? You know, the black and the white hair, right? I used to go with the whole, I'd get the question, you know, the little questions, because I was one of maybe like 10 punk rock students at Shepherd at the time. What does it mean? And I would say, you know, the yin and yang, the light and the dark, the Jungian thing, the duality of human nature. Took that straight from a Full Metal Jacket, but that seemed to work. But I loved that fashion. One of my favorite things to do when I had my hair all half blonde and half black and wore all black leather clothes was to take my grandmother to the Golden Corral. And it was always one of the most entertaining things for me to get the stares and the look. So I have one last antique I'd like to share with you guys. And in keeping with our literary tradition that we've established here, I'm going to read the lyrics of my all-time favorite punk rock song from that era. This is the Cro-Mags, Age of Quarrel, from 1985. This record is actually 30 years old. One of my all-time favorite punk rock bands. I was fortunate enough to see the original lineup when I was 21.
And recently, I think in 2012, my idol, Harley Flanagan, who had eventually got kicked out of the band, knifed the new bass player and frontman. So, you know, here they are 20 years later still making new. Would you guys like to hear some lyrics? You don't have any choice. Keegan, damn you for running late. This is Seekers of the Truth from the Cro-Mags. This album came out in 1985, one of the greatest hardcore bands I'd ever seen. I feel very fortunate to have gotten to see these guys. And I feel very fortunate for the life that I've lived as an artist. Now, I don't know whether or not the leather and the ball gags and all that represent the avant-garde, but I would definitely say I lived a very interesting life. Those, the leather mask and the ball gag, would end up in my artwork quite a bit at that period. And this song speaks a little bit to how I like to use bondage, at least back then, as a symbol. This is Seekers of the Truth, and it went something like this. Wasting my time, serving my mind, for sense pleasures I can find. Gotta get back to the truth. You know that it was left behind. It's so easy to see. If you want to be free, don't want to be just a slave. Because no matter how you choose, you know you lose if you ain't looking for the truth. Searching and searching for something real, you gotta know how I feel. Because we've been looking after the truth, rejected those lies of our youth. You've seen the proof, this ain't no spoof, they tried to bend the truth. And we won't regret the things we met if we're on the path of righteousness. Now we gotta go back. Something ain't right, so we gotta go back. Trace our steps and see what we've done. It's time for us to go back to square one. You just can't seem to see what I mean. You know what I'm talking about. Because we've been in bondage much too long. Don't you think it's time to get out? See, time has taken its toll and they're in control. We can't let this madness last. We gotta make our move, get in a groove. We gotta do something fast. Cro-Mags, 1985. Hope you guys enjoy the rest of the program this evening. Keegan, that was your break.
For a great sense of contrast and duality between those spoken words and mine. So the first poem I have is called Child Gaze, The Unraveling. Sitting inside, slowly I see the unraveling of every craving. Each one circled into the next, my own creation, a world of suffering. Fear of suffering brings only that. Perfect practice is a contradiction. I relinquish the word unfortunate and see the world that is. Trust and compassion dissolve as craving root illusion. Each of us our own scribe, in our hands an unwritten book, destiny. Every mindful breath body rewrites old neuroplastic pathways arriving in the place, in this place, so still. I have my permission to be happy right now. I descend the spokes, I let go. I fall into the opening hearts, the presence of which resides in the continuous moments. My eyes open clean from tears, breath feels full, body clear and hollow. A great joy walking down the pine wood steps in this home. My 5-year-old heart reappears because I'm looking at it. The child gaze is awakened. The next poem I wrote, thank you. Just wrote this poem briefly while I was in the Outer Banks with some of the family. And this one's called The Breath I Breathe Again. I'm the member equal whole one, moving as the way, center in love. For days I have sat offering myself the phrase love and compassion. For days I have sat there, like a 3-year-old across the table from this heart, with a closed mouth as if offered astringent broccoli. Only now did I say I accept my love. And I fling forth into streaming harp infinite, every practiced asana, every meditation, every hymn and prayer, they all have dissolved, mingled into the single harmonic solvent. Yes, here I see desire and condition, neither wrong, neither good. Then both I see, closer to one, for I, awake I am. Winds of grace ascends, the love you are, I am, said in a single voice blends. The body turns warm, I ask, when will I see you again? The reply is shouted in the sight of world soil, such a mess of tangible wonder, wood, water, human, cloud, art. How can I stay right here? The breath, I breathe again. Thank you. Let's see. This one is Dream Terrace, and it's obviously written about a dream that I had a few weeks ago. I walk the cobbled courtyard path, scaling the terrace dreamscape. My hands graze the stacked stone wall, and then I arrive here. Expressions of the same source are pouring now, like every tiny quartz grain in the disentangled mountain. The soul's journey to the body, longing to know its final return. If you want to know the meaning of my poetry, it's to be that divine expression, that single dot of the great canopy of impression, yoked in the same electric masterpiece, a single vibration resonating inside vast dose and hum, the one unseen universal sea. These are words circling around what is eloquent sound free. Thank you. It's another poem I wrote back in July called Welcome Home. I've been sitting around my house today. For the first time, I notice its space. Doorways to new rooms, the silence between voices on the TV. Christmas mint green tea pours from the pot into a blue striped Cornwall cup. Emptiness flows out of my mouth, into the teacup, back into the pot. The snapdragons in the vase open their polychasm with a gentle pinch. The Tao Te Ching sits before me, filled with hollow pages. I sip and swallow. Again, nothing comes up. I'm dreaming again. I sit inside the home. I abide in its nothingness. Such vacancy is free. My legs extend under this small dinner table, here in small sphere. Now I step out onto the porch. Open July sky, 9:30 p.m. forest silhouettes. Yet I haven't left the dwelling. It's nowhere inside everything, falling redbud leaf and more spacious things. That is why everywhere feels like a happy home. Home is the space that gives life. The surrounding love womb weaves through my chest and gives source to beating heart. And this is one I just wrote the other night called Between the Lungs. Dharma depths of heart. I sit. I could be standing or walking, even lying down, perhaps in deep sleep or even dreaming. I'm of such essential nature, happy to always reveal myself true here, even more through dying. I cannot say the word inside the word or consider myself who I am. This tongue only separates and connects, just as the trunk of a tree does so to roots and branched leaves. This is the place where I bow into energy's harmonic wandering. In opening circles, I accept this lissom river journey out beyond centered sternum, between the lungs I breathe. And, the next two poems I have are concern a journey I took to Spain back in February. I wanted to go see the Alhambra and in Granada. For those of you who don't know what that is, it's a Muslim palace, and it's has very intricate architecture and artwork inside. And this is the poem and story of walking through that palace. It's called A Familiar Courtyard. I arrive here now in a foreign familiar courtyard, situated within the center of a Nasrid dynasty. The walls here are speaking in an Arabesque tongue. The same sacred melodic drops echo inside the boundless corridors of my chest. I arrive here again. This ancient mosque has been carved into the same dazzling purple-gold geometry in which I dwell. How am I here again? Left silent like the space that follows after a glory ring bell. I wander this palace, Alhambra, just as I have circle walked the inner majesty whose water is nourished through every spring garden. The carved squares encase their circle rows in my palm. A home is born in the foundation of fire, water, air, and stone. I arrive here, barely walking, empty now in the same spirit as the hollowed ceiling chambers. There I am crafted, the center of which is hardly seen. The nightingale returns home to tall cypress tree, nestled below in fragrant alpine valley. Lilacs are already dancing in the garden, as I feel a green bud on the juniper tree just starting to grow. I have been here, still I am, since this kingdom first sat on this hill, spilling over its edge in discourse and mathematical communion. Nothing is separate here, not the morning dove coo, nor the smell of fresh pine descending there on its sheltered path back to the open gateway. I'm home now. This castle is called. I respond with a silent, soft walk into the divine blossom which I am. When I stumbled, I was reading through my old poetry the other night, and I stumbled across this other poem that combines two themes that I've already read about, the Alhambra and a dream that I had while I was in Spain. So just give me a second to flip to it here. Here we go. This one, I never wrote a title for, so. I wake today in another country, longing to hold my beloved friend as I did in my dream last night, now gone from me and from me or any sense of I. She sat waiting. I raised her in elation to see such loving presence, then sat down and embraced. Don't go. Don't go. I wept in that plain and woke to the same longing of a spring home of redbud and valleys thousands of miles away, an ocean separating me. Such a bud somehow has followed me, like a lily pad broken free, floating every distance of the stream to sea. Secret waters touch this green bud as first April rain breathes the earth awake from winter's closed slumber. When such tendrils descend, I turn all palm and go great in great union and greet you union again. Grief is the mighty herald home, the same original hum at the bottom of every desire. Carry me there, just as you do, fragrant jasmine from the dormant air. And that's all I have for you guys tonight. Thank you. And thanks to Earl for hosting everybody and sending me the emails. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Steve? Can you hear me? The first thing I want to do is apologize to Don. Don, you shocked me. I had no right to be vocal about it. I apologize. So, what I'm doing now is I'm in the midst of a project of creating a novel out of sonnets, which are 14-line poems which usually stand on their own. So far, I have 72 of them. There will probably be about double that number by the time I'm done. Because some of you have already heard the beginnings of this story, I decided to read you some that occur, 15 or 20 sonnets into it. So I'm just going to briefly summarize what comes first, if that's okay. There's this guy. He's a guy from Queens, New York. He's a director now in Hollywood. He's hanging out in the cemetery in Rome, Italy, where the famous English poet who died very young, John Keats, is buried. While paying his respects to John Keats, he sees a beautiful Italian woman of perhaps, in her late 30s. He's considerably older than that. He introduces herself and she flees across the cemetery, running away from him, and he pursues, and eventually she stops. And they have a little cat and mouse game that goes on from the cemetery, through a restaurant, and into a beautiful neighborhood called the Aventine, where they have dinner. She tells him that the reason she fled him is she thinks, since she's running away from her gangster husband, that he was one of the gangsters, or one of the minions, that he might have sent after her to bring her back. Against his better judgment, he's in that hotel, or he's at that hotel, Lavinia Fumento, who is the wife of a gangster named Cesare Fumento. So she brought him back to her hotel. A handsome relic from another time, she said, like you. Your wit has made the climb worthwhile, he said. Just let me rest a spell inside, and if I fall asleep, then you can tell me later it was really quite sublime. We live like gods, and it would be a crime indeed if ever we should say farewell. So how'd it go? They were, in fact, Olympian. To judge by all the squeals and laughters, it was clear, and also just to judge by every kiss. You are a flower, said Jerome. Your skin is soft as petals here and even, she whispered, speak with this. So morning rolls around, and he watches her emerge from the bath, and he watches her come down the hallway to retrieve a towel from a closet, and he watches her go back into the bath. Then came a knock. He called to Vigna, sun's up, time for coffee, lover, padded to the door, and found a pair of thugs with guns were waiting for him there. The first one threw Jerome against the wall. The second, quite the cool one, struck a brooding gangster pose, then nonchalantly hit him with his right. Said he, Arcadi, stuff some pantyhose in this guy's mouth. No, first we ought to know his name, and that is? When Jerome replied, the thug said, ah, you have a saint's name. And so I guess you know the average saint, he died a martyr. You, though, are about to lose your life for screwing Vigna. She's the boss's wife. Now Vigna entered and surprised Jerome by showing little in the way of fear. Oh, say it isn't you, Alfeo, driving home with you. It will be so boring with you yakking in my ear. Alfeo said, and this old codger, that you wore him out. Just looking at the bed, I'm surprised the old boy isn't dead. Jerome, at gunpoint, not so much frightened as confused, endured a pang of brokenheartedness. The only thing he knew for sure was he'd been used. But used for what and why was anybody's guess? Dismayed, Alfeo said. I know just how you feel. Now, if you would, remove your robe and kneel. Afraid not, pal, said Tom Jerome. Forgive me, but this ain't the way that I intend when it arrives at last to meet my end. So listen, killing me is your prerogative, but if you let me live, should I survive intact, this could turn out to be your lucky break. I know you love the movies. You should act. I've come to Italy with plans to make a gangster film. I'll need a leading man. When all my backers ask me who could be the one, I'll tell them you. And there's a buddy role as well. Who better than Arcadi here? You're on the road to fame and dough, and all you have to do is let me go. And yes, they bought it in their leather jackets, one with silver studs, just two prospective movie stars with guns, tattoos, and gang-related scars. Well, Vigna, laughing, said, what have you done? Already laying out a suitcase on the bed, you'll take a useful homicidal hood and ruin him with dreams of Hollywood.
You're one to talk of dreams and ruins, Amelia, said Jerome, relieved to be alive, but still. She packed her things. Arcadi went to fetch the car. Alfeo leaned against the windowsill and turned his good side to the light. The wretch had put his faith in an absurdity. But then Jerome remembered. So had he. Indeed, she was the first one out the door, and when he spoke and tried to catch her eye, she neither turned his way nor said goodbye. So much for all that stuff the night before. Alfeo, on the other hand, gave him the number for his cell. I will await your call, he said, a kind of synonym, Jerome assumed, for better not be late. Oh, sure, I'll call, Jerome replied. The sky's the limit, boys. The lack of any speck of talent, all the bogus gangsterisms. Guys, I gotta say, I fed you all that movie direct just so you wouldn't shoot me in the head. Oh, really? Call me anyway, Alfeo said. So now, appearing solo in that hotel suite, a fellow in the aging Al Pacino mold, left feeling impotent and obsolete, bereft and cast aside, but mostly old. Was anything that Vigna told Jerome a lie? Just lines in an Italian play in which the wife routinely runs away, has her adventure, and is chauffeured home? Yet what if this were so? It only meant that she was doing what he'd often done, with nothing but his guile, beguile someone. It was, in fact, a kind of compliment, but this one felt so odd, so faded to black. If only for a while he thought, I want it back. Couple more? Okay. There are a few sonnets that come next with Jerome ruminating over love, death, art. This all comes pretty easily to him. But after a day or so, he calls Alfeo, the fellow, the gangster who wants to be an actor and who gave him a cell number. Alfeo says, well, meet me at this restaurant. And when Jerome gets there, riding on a Vespa that he's borrowed from his tailor, he finds that the restaurant is named Vigna. And Vigna is the hostess, and her gangster husband is the owner. So Jerome pulls up on his Vespa. Alfeo, drowsy as a crocodile, bestirred himself and said, I must confess that you look edible in evening dress. And pouring on the charm, the Sicilian style, revealed a brilliant, if reptilian, smile. The street was dark, and this was Matt the Knife. But Tom Jerome was thinking, what's my life that I should clutch it to me like a vial of nitroglycerin? If it should blow, then I'll have lived a bit before I go. He made his way inside. A smile curled as subtly as a wisp of smoke across his face. Because his thoughts on seeing Vigna's place were movie thoughts, he murmured in a world. A world, that is, of billionaires, of men whose lives are chronicles of power and prestige, of ones who once might have been called my liege. This restaurant is where they take their wives, who get an evening out, a string of pearls, to say they're still desired after all. While through the forest, frescoed on the wall, immortal gods pursue the local girls. These moguls would pursue the hostess here, except they know that chasing Vigna might mean being murdered in the dark one night. They say, how nice you look this evening, dear. These men are rich, but each is just a man. The gods in frescoes cannot die. They can. So we see Vigna in action, and she's moving from table to table, and she's chatting. She's the most beautiful and glamorous woman in the room. While at the bar, the lone American is drinking on the house. It's Stoli rocks. There's always been a part of him that mocks the rich, but makes exceptions when the drinks are free. But what is this abrupt disruption? Something like a sonic boom made human. Cesare is in the room. The big man says, don't let me interrupt, but none complain, not if they love their lives. He says to Tom Jerome, so you're the guy, so you're the movie guy, then pauses and contrives so frankly murderous a cast of eye, as would have anybody fearing for his life. You fuck my wife, he says, you fuck my wife. Which should be scary, but it's wonderful. Jerome is trying not to roll his eyes. He's just been tickled by a wild surmise. De Niro, right? You're doing Raging Bull. And Cesare, now all aglow, shouts, so, you are a movie guy. My boy here tells me you make better films than Orson Welles. Can this be true? There must be much to know about a man like you. Let's go inside and have some dinner. After you've been plied with pleasures you will never find at home, you'll realize you've got a friend in Rome, which can be useful here if things get rough. It happens. Not to worry. I'm a movie buff. That's it. Thank you.
Steve Altman. Our next performer will be Mr. Grady. Come on up here, Mike Grady. After Mike Grady, we're going to do the Scum Collaborators, and then we're going to take a brief intermission, and hopefully by then, Mr. Ramirez will be up here set up ready to do his drums. So, ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Mike Grady. I'll make you one special for you, Mr. Grady. Very special for you.
Please don't call me Mr. Jeez, I feel so old. This first one is called R.I.P. I guess everybody knows what that means, right? From money came their interest. From capital came their trust. Their profits could not see their principal. Thus the Iron Age came to rust. Second one is called Ask Any Man. Socrates was a man contemplative and wise, as were Plato and Aristotle. Buddha and Moses were men, as were Jesus and Muhammad, enlightened spiritual beings glowing through the darkness of time. Galileo and Darwin were also men, and Newton and Einstein, and most of history's gifted scientists. Marx was a man, and Nietzsche, Freud, and Jung pushing back the boundaries of the mind to see itself more clearly. Ask any man. The greatest thinkers have been men. Yet, which of these epitomes of intelligence has revealed to us, out of their own personal experience, the most important thing a man needs to know in this life? How to love a woman. I can tell you if you're interested, not one. Perhaps only women know the answer. If so, I hope at least one of them will tell us men soon and end our mutual misery. The heart of despair. The greatest human fear, life being greater than reason, to never experience life's true essence, desperately desired, unrealized, hidden by jealous lies, painfully eluding the strain of our brains before we die. Next one is called Moon Waves. Lying on the beach, October, Indian summer day, near noon, the sun warms me. I catch sight of the cool, pale moon. Deep blue waves loudly crash up sparkling white sands, playfully chasing sandpipers towards the dunes. As with people, nature makes no two ocean waves the same. Invisible lunar hands reach out to Mother Earth, mysteriously move and shape them, much as they do rhythms of the womb and what lovers swoon. We seldom see those hidden forces of chance that shape our fate. Perhaps we should seek them, expose our foolish folly, that we control our destiny to be great. Diminish that dark, impending doom that much too often sends us unhappily too soon to tombs. This is entitled, When My World Ends. Lying in bed, neither asleep nor awake, paralyzed in the present, hopelessly ruminating, contemplating, vacillating between memories of past pain and future fantasies of pleasure. My life, such as it is all I have. Yet I find myself starving amidst abundance, out of touch, completely alone on a planet populated by billions, overwhelmed by opinions of the minions, no one to talk to or understand, no one to call, nothing worth hearing, nothing new, nothing true, no one to listen or write a letter to. Nothing as far as the eye can see. Darkness. invisible, drowning in a hostile sea of ambivalence in my avaricious mediocrity, enslaved by freedom, outvoted by democracy, seeking answers in a world without questions, at least not mine. Numb to sublimations of fortune and fame, tricks for love, power games. Yet I know when that final feeling fades, the power of death will embrace me, though I continue to breathe and walk. Is it over? I know people die, but do they live? I mean, do they really live? I don't believe so. How could we? Buried from birth beneath a horrible dirt of love, creating insatiable fallacious needs from which gods depreve, in a dark world by beings who lost their souls when they turned their back on nature's promise, betraying all hope for peace on earth, placing trust in lethal power and heartless lust, blindly demanding senseless duty. The meaning of life. For most, the meaning of life means to be close to the mean, the average, the commonplace, the lackluster, the mundane, mediocre, unaccomplished. Those who worship God, country, easily fooled by those who tell them all men are created equal, that we are free. Lies which produce the second meaning of life for the majority. To be mean, cruel, murderous, aggressive, greedy, abusive, sadistic, stingy, violent, jealous, vindictive, uncooperative, violent, unfriendly. To name but a few of the more endearing qualities. Why seek the meaning of life at all? The question presupposes a teleology, God's creed, a plan imposed on existence from the beginning of time, which nullifies free will. But then God's only answer to themselves, their meaning a great cosmic secret, promising eternal life. Is not the search for life's meaning driven by the haunting awareness of death, that our lives must end? The gnawing question begs for more, an afterlife. Are we not the gods we wish to worship, the same gods we pray to for love? Let us change the proposition of life's meaning by changing the preposition of. Thus seek meaning in life, to gain meaning from life, to give meaning to life, to death, and maybe beyond. Just have a couple more. This is called Shells. This is a two-page one. This is the longest one. Early morning, strolling along the beach, I feel youthful once again, filled with curiosity and anticipating childish delights of discovery. Stormy waves cast a plethora of seashells upon the land, an endless wonder of color, sizes, and shapes galore, brightly glistening on sunlit sand. Most mere fragments, dull and ordinary, crushed by pounding breakers, still, with persistence, one finds shimmering gems wholly unscathed as they must have looked bathed in their watery world below. No signs of former occupants, craters of these intricate marbles, no clue as to how they, the lives they led, who they ate, or who they fed. Some believe we came from the ocean eons ago, so I ponder the shells we produce, like our oceanic cousins. We should cure ourselves with them, attract mates. Do we not as they do with our houses and gates, artwork, architecture, monuments made for all to appreciate, books, music, film, paintings and sculptures, poems and ideas, used to interest friends and lovers, increasing chances to procreate. Grand techniques, each one unique, to build a world while hunting, trapping, deceiving, invading, preying upon fellow creatures striving to survive. Attempts to leave immortal shells on the sands of time are mostly lost and forgotten. Despite life's crushing surf, many rare and beautiful shells may be discovered that continue to inspire the mind's eye toward a new kind of seeing, endlessly expanding life with a deeper sense of believing, indifferent to fears of death, faithfully inevitability, transcendent remnants bequeathed by exquisite beings. Though our shells no more tell others who we were than those of mollusks, no matter how brightly they shine in the sunlight of someone's tomorrow, legacies left behind do not reveal if they were good, if they were kind. If we knew beauty, were a friend, sought the truth until the end. I smile at our pusillanimous pretensions, our preposterous preoccupations with posterity, our places in history, fortune and fame, things in life bringing strife and shame, blinding vision during each moment we live to find peace with nature's essence, for it is only there that love dwells, never found in calcified shells. Just one more. It's called Evil. And Noah's neighbors screamed in vain at an evil god as the rains came. Naked gasping Jews in poison gas showers cursed high evil Hitler and the Germans. Chained Africans on slave ships didn't understand the acts of evil white captors. All slaughtered inhabitants of the promised land undoubtedly saw Hebrews as evil. Primitives everywhere saw civilized man bring disease and end their existence. Tens of millions died at the hands of evil Stalin, bringing the good of communism. Japanese survivors grieved because of the mushroom clouds made by the evil Americans. Infidels about to be beheaded spat hate at the evil Islamic jihadist, on and on. I wonder, is evil merely blind to itself? If it were truly conscious, could so many horrors have been heaped upon humanity? Or is it inherent in the greed, power, creeds, lust, ideologies of self-assured leaders and followers, adherence to an insanity of vanity, fear, and ignorance? They say we are violent by nature, war inevitable, the poor with us always. The dreams of poets for utopia, Garden of Eden, laughable foolishness. But even if this were true, shouldn't we still strive to reduce the strife that strangles life, that reduces us to much less than what we might become? Let us say, yeah, yes, what harm can it do? Become as children with new eyes to see healthy, happy possibilities beneath our imperfections and illusions. It may take more than a little honest heart to feel our way past the lies to that better place promised by the prophets. Yet let us try.
We're going to take approximately a 5 to 10 minute intermission so everyone can stretch, use the restroom. Then we're going to go with the Stump collaborators, and hopefully Edwin Ramirez will be here by then. If not, unfortunately, that part of the program won't happen. So give us 5 to 10 minutes, get another drink water in, stretch legs, use the restroom. Stump, let's get ready, guys.
Go to the bathroom and don't pay any attention to me. So part of what we're trying to do here is build this art community in Martinsburg. I know a lot of the faces that we see here are not really from the downtown area. So what we're trying to do, just like Doreen Conrad in the rear, one of my favorite celebrities of Martinsburg, we try to build this arts community, and that's what we've been doing with these programs. And by doing this, you guys also patronize a family-owned business, which I find very important. There's not many shops like Good Natured in this region. It's a real pleasure to have this shop in Martinsburg, and I appreciate you guys contributing to that family-run business. One of the reasons we picked this venue is because it's not part of a larger corporation. You have a direct impact in your immediate community by patronizing this shop. And I think what we do with this, too, is a lot of people who have never been here before get to see what Good Nature is all about. So for our host, let's have a solid round of applause for Good Nature and staff. Thank you, guys. This up, we're out of here before 8 o'clock. Good Nature closes at 8. But anyone that would like to join us for an adult beverage at the Peking, we're going to stop down and have a drink or so at the Peking restaurant in their little bar in the rear. Stop by and chit chat, continue to socialize. All right, the next thing that we have in this program before we do our wrap up. If our drummer shows up, I'm definitely going to give him some time, but I don't think that's going to happen because it's already after 7 o'clock. I spoke with him at 5. He told me he was going to be here, so I apologize, but it is what it is. So the next part of our program is R, the Scum Collaborators. So the person that's going to introduce this piece is Mr. Ed Zonizer. And my friend Sean Craig, Calvin Smith, and myself are going to be reading from the 1967 publication Scum Manifesto. Mr. Zonizer.
Thanks, Don. The four short readings that follow are excerpts from the 1967 Manifesto by Valerie Solanas, head of the Society for Cutting Up Men. The manifesto is known by the organization's initials, SCUM, the Scum Manifesto. Solanas is most notorious for having shot and wounded pop artist Andy Warhol. In the interest of time, please hold all hooting, hollering, jubilant utterance, snickering, and robust applause for the end of each reading. Life in this society being, at best, an utter bore, and no aspect of society being at all relevant to women, there remains to civic-minded, responsible, thrill-seeking females only to overthrow the government, eliminate the money system, institute complete automation, and destroy the male sex. It is now technically feasible to reproduce without the aid of males, or for that matter, females, and to produce only females. We must begin immediately to do so. Retaining the male has not even the dubious purpose of reproduction. The male is a biological accident. The Y, or male gene, is an incomplete X female gene. That is, it has an incomplete set of chromosomes. In other words, the male is an incomplete female, a walking abortion aborted at the gene stage. To be male is to be deficient, emotionally limited. Maleness is a deficiency disease, and males are emotional cripples. The male is completely egocentric, trapped inside himself, incapable of empathizing or identifying with others, or love, friendship, affection, or tenderness. He is completely isolated, a completely isolated unit, incapable of rapport with anyone. His responses are entirely visceral, not cerebral. His intelligence is a mere tool in the service of his drives and needs. He is incapable of mental passion, mental interaction. He can't relate to anything other than his own physical sensations. He is a half-dead, unresponsive lump, incapable of giving or receiving pleasure or happiness. Consequently, he is at best an utter bore, an inoffensive blob, since only those capable of absorption in others can be charming.
Quite a thing to clap to, huh? The male has a negative Midas touch. Everything he touches, it turns to shit. The male is just a bunch of conditioned reflexes, incapable of a mentally free response. He is tied to his earliest conditioning, determined completely by his past experiences. His earliest experiences are with his mother, and he is throughout his life tied to her. It never becomes completely clear to the male that he is not part of his mother, that he is he, and that she is she. His greatest need is to be guided, sheltered, protected, and admired by mama. Men expect women to adore what men shrink from in horror, themselves. And being completely physical, he yearns to spend his time, that's not spent out in the world, grimly defending his passivity, wallowing in basic animal activities, eating, shitting, sleeping, relaxing, and being soothed by mama. Passive, rattle-headed daddy's girl, ever eager for approval, for a pat on the head, for the respect, if any passing piece of garbage is easily reduced to mama, mindless administrator of physical needs, soother of the weary, baby brow, booster of the tiny ego, appreciator of the contemptible, a hot water bottle with tits. Reducing the female to an animal, to mama, to a male, is necessary for psychological as well as practical reasons. The male is a mere member of the species, interchangeable with every other male. He has no deep-seated individuality, which stems from what intrigues you, what outside yourself absorbs you, and what you're in relation to. Completely self-absorbed, capable of being in relationship only to their bodies and physical sensations, males differ from each other only to the degree and in the ways they attempt to defend against their passivity and against their desire to be female.
Hey, you can applaud, it's okay.
To call a man an animal is to flatter him. He's a machine, a walking dildo. It's often said that men use women. Use them for what? Surely not for pleasure. Unable to get love or affection, the male gives money. Makes him feel motherly. The mother gives milk, he gives bread. He is the breadwinner. I've been an obsessive desire to be admired by women, but no intrinsic worth. The male constructs a highly artificial society, enabling him to appropriate the appearance of worth through money, prestige, high social class, degrees, professional position and knowledge, and by pushing as many other men as possible down professionally, socially, economically, and educationally. The purpose of higher education is not to educate, but to exclude as many as possible from the various professions. The male, totally physical, incapable of mental rapport, although able to understand and use knowledge and ideas, is unable to relate to them, to grasp them emotionally. Does not value knowledge and ideas for their own sake, they're just means to ends, and, consequently, feels no need for mental companions, no need to cultivate the intellectual potentialities of others. On the contrary, the male has a vested interest in ignorance. It gives the few knowledgeable men a decided edge on the unknowledgeable ones, and besides, the male knows that an enlightened, aware female population will mean the end of him. The healthy, conceited female wants the company of equals whom she can respect and brood on. The male and the sick, insecure, unself-confident male female crave the company of worms. No genuine social revolution can be accomplished by the male, as the male on top wants the status quo, and the male on the bottom wants is to be the male on top. The male rebel is a farce. This is the male society made by him to falsify his, to satisfy his needs. He's never satisfied because he's not capable of being satisfied. Ultimately, but the male rebel is rebelling against his being male. The male changes only when forced to do so by technology, when he has no choice, when society reaches the stage where he must change or die. Just as humans have a prior right to existence over dogs by virtue of being more highly evolved and having a superior consciousness, so women have a prior right to existence over men. The elimination of any male is, therefore, a righteous and good act, an act highly beneficial to women as well as an act of mercy.
Valerie Solanas has concluded the manifesto with this final paragraph. The sick, irrational men, those who attempt to defend themselves against their disgustingness, when they see scum barreling down on them, will cling in terror to Big Mama with her big, bouncy boobies. But boobies won't protect them against scum. Big Mama will be clinging to Big Daddy, who will be in the corner, shitting in his forceful, dynamic pants. Men who are rational, however, won't kick or struggle or raise a distressing fuss, but will just sit back, relax, enjoy the show, and ride the waves to their demise. Valerie Solanas, 1967. Thank you, guys. Next part of our program, I'm going to invite my partner in crime, Mr. Earl Harrison, to come up with Steve Altman, Kagan Abernathy, and Mike Grady to do a little Q&A. Earl's going to ask you guys a few questions about your writings. We like to do the audience. If you guys have any questions for these guys, one of the things that we like is to have a little bit of discourse between the audience and the performers tonight. So take advantage of this.
Exactly. How are you doing? He's got a plug to make. Make the plug. I really enjoyed the show. It's good to see everybody here tonight. We have another show coming up the 26th of September. And so do Guys and Dolls. There's been a theme all along. The first one was Ladies Night. This one, Boys Club. And the next one will be Guys and Dolls. And so we, are you the only guys that have been up here? We are. And so Steve, I'd like to give you the mic. We've enjoyed each and every one of you all's performances tonight. And we're glad that you're here. And we just want to give you the mic and we'll ask you questions.
Sure. Does anybody want to know what comes next? James.
Yeah.
What comes next is an interminable 40 more sonnets of people driving around Rome at night, worried about what's going to happen, because I haven't quite figured it out. But the sonnets do pile up, and the interesting thing about writing a novel made out of sonnets is that the delight, at least for the author, is not so much in what happens next, as in what happens in this sonnet that would make somebody want to read the next one. So I only wrote one novel, a regular novel, previous to this, but what I learned from the experience was that the only goal of every page turned out, the only feasible, worthwhile goal was, will they turn the page and read the next one? And the only measure of whether the written work is successful is whether anybody finished it. And with the sonnets, it turns out that if I stop right now, someone could have read the 72 and said, well, that was fine. And if I eventually finish it, which I will, if there are 150 of them, it will be the same thing. Does each sonnet give you the incentive to keep going? If you open up in the middle of the book, would you want to look around and read other ones? So as a writer, I'll finish this, as a writer, there's an advantage in helping you keep the project going, in that you have the satisfaction of completing something almost every week or two. You finish a sonnet, and when you're writing a novel, or you finish a few pages or something, but it doesn't feel like something is complete. With the sonnets, it does.
Thanks, Steve.
Thank you.
I'll just start. Does anybody have any questions about any of my poems?
Keegan, can you tell us a little bit about yourself, your age, education, things like
that?
Yeah, so that's how you got started. Absolutely.
Yeah, that sounds perfect. So my name is Keegan Abernathy. I'm 23 years old. Recently graduated from Towson University with my bachelor's and bachelor's of science in psych. Now going to Hood College for my graduate degree. And I started writing poetry just about a little over a year ago, about a year and a half ago. So I guess I missed my calling as an English major, and as an undergrad, I don't know. But I was, it was sort of spur of the moment, it came on suddenly. I was inspired by Colvin Barks' translations of Rumi, and prior to that I really didn't have a huge interest in poetry. But I would say that Coleman's translations and Rumi, I think it's a story of opening the heart. And I heard Coleman Barks, what was said to the rose, was said to me here in my chest, what was said to Cyprus, that made it strong and straight. And the first time I heard that poem, I just felt it, like, just instantly, just piercing, and, like, deers, and like it was this crazy experience. And after that, I just felt inspired to share that divine nature, whatever you want to call it. So that's the continual source for me. That's where all my poems seem to kind of emerge from. And so that's the story of writing poetry for the past year and a half. So yeah, thank you guys.
I'd like to apologize for being a man. I didn't have any choice, but here I am. I'm from Columbus, Ohio. I have degrees in psychology, physics, and education. I have my own company that makes high-powered V8s for ships and helicopters here in Martinsburg. We were the exporter of the year for the state a few years back. Moderately successful and almost famous. As far as writing.
And handsome, too!
Oh, God, I know. Anyway, as far as writing poetry, I feel like I just kind of witness it and write it down. It just comes to me out of dreams and observations. And it may be partly genetic. My uncle, who was a beatnik poet from the Greenwich Village, said that it's born into, not made, you can't make it. But I just kind of witness it, more or less. And just to close with one short story that happened to me. My most famous encounter with feminism and angry women was up in Frederick at Hood College. Germaine Greer, who wrote the Female Eunuch, was speaking to, at that time it was strictly women's college. And so to prepare myself, I read the Female Eunuch before I went to the lecture, and the last page it says, women should never marry. So I went to the lecture, and she talked about the whole time her husband. So after the lecture, she was standing out with the president and some co-eds hanging around her, all drinking wine. It was very nice. And I was drinking, had a few drinks, and I wandered over to her to ask her a question, and just as I got there, she said, "Screw men." And I said, "I couldn't agree more. I think women should screw men much more frequently than they do." And she turned around, looked at me, and said, "Who are you?" A little aggressive. And I said, "Well, I was just a person who was wondering if you betrayed your own message in your book by getting married." And she looked at me right in the eye and said, "You'll die before I do." And then the president of the college whisked her off. But I'd just like to say, Germaine Greer has died, but I haven't visited her grave yet. But I plan to. Any questions?
I'd like to ask the SCUM collaborators to come up and take a moment to introduce themselves as well.
Thank you guys so much for your time, effort, and energy. Mike Grady, Steve Altman, and Keegan Abernathy, one last time! Yeah! My name is Don Ramirez. I graduated from Shepherd College. I did undergraduate studies at Shepherd, Frederick Community College, Maryland Institute College of Art, and UMBC. I studied film at UMBC. Got my degree in 1995, but that's a whole other story. So I'm going to pass this on to Ed. And is Calvin still around?
We might have backpacked out.
Yes, hello. My name is Ed Zonizer. I was born in Washington, D.C., raised in the Maryland suburbs. I grew up in a house full of books, about 2,000 volumes of simply poetry and drama, with a lot of other books on natural history and art. And so I guess I couldn't escape getting interested in poetry, and started writing in about the ninth grade, and edited literary magazines in high school and college, and had great dreams of being an English professor and got drafted during Vietnam, but fortunately sent to Korea and edited newspapers. I've always been embarrassed with the question, what did you do in the war, Daddy? Well, I edited newspapers. So, and then I worked for an environmental group, and then briefly for a group of labor unions as like a publicist and producer of magazines and newsletters. And then my wife Christine Gould and I moved up here in 1977 because the National Park Service was ignorant enough to offer me a job, not knowing that I would stay for 36 years. I recently retired, and I love having free time because that's the only way you can make all your doctor's appointments when you get as old as I am. So that's about all I know. If you have any questions, ask. I'll be glad to try to answer them, but I don't want to put pressure on you.
Sean.
All right, I'm Sean. Yes, I grew up fairly close to Mr. Ramirez, and I'm probably fairly fortunate that I did, in the respect that I grew up very poor like Don, and came from a very eclectic family that moved around a lot. So I went off and joined the Marine Corps, and when I came back, I'd always been a part of the art movement. I was with Don in the 80s then, and but that ultimately led me to going to college where I have a degree in psychology. I find it fairly unique. I'm not familiar with y'all's crowd, but at least four of you have degrees in psychology, so I find it kind of unique that we're all here now. And then today, I've moved around a good bit, but now I'm a local realtor in our area, and that's what I do to hold down the fort. And Don, it has been a privilege for the last 25 or 30 years, really soon.
With, I'll say something real quick about the scum. Scum had been kind of floating around as an idea for a while that I'd had. I don't know how many people are familiar with the book or the story, but if you get the opportunity, I suggest seeing the film I Shot Andy Warhol. An amazing film. And are there any Soprano fans out here? Sopranos? No, Soprano? I mean, is it that long ago?
HBO shows?
Yeah, The Sopranos. You'll see Chrissy in I Shot Andy Warhol before The Sopranos series started. So Michael Imperioli, I think is how his name is pronounced, he has a great role in it. It's a great film. I have it on VHS, where I'd offer to loan it to you guys, but I collect videotapes. But that concludes our program. I hope you guys enjoyed. Please come out for our last program is the last Saturday of September. So please come out, have something to eat, and have a lot of fun. I want to introduce my friend Chris, who did the recording. He's going to talk a little bit about what he did. Do you want to do that, Chris?
I promoted a little bit.
There you go.
Hi, folks. As you've seen, a lot of people stare at this little device down here, which we have our show, which is called the Long Coat Mafia Podcast. Our little sidekick over here is called Uncle Tony. He helps us out, record a lot of the shows. He gives us a lot of feedback and reviews to do. The Long Coat Mafia Podcast is a geek-related podcast with a mafioso twist to it. Because we feel that everybody is geek about something, whether it be poetry, comics, movies, music, whatever, that's what we put out. We do interviews, hostfuls, we do kind of a campfire story readings. There's something for everyone. This will be posted up at our website at thelongcoatmafia.podbean.com. That should be put up on Monday. Those who are performing here or performing here tonight, see Don for the link, and I'll let him know as soon as it's posted, and he'll get the word out. Right now we have, when I last checked it before the show, we have currently 1,120 listeners so far to date, with only about 14 episodes up right now. I laugh when we call our podcast the premier panhandle podcast because it seems like I'm the only one promoting this, getting the community out, and being the aspect of getting Martinsburg community up and around something, whether it's our Rinky Dink Club podcast and the listeners from all across the country. Me, like Don, do thank you for showing up tonight. And if there is a good listener turnout, I'll be here on the 26th to record again. And hope you guys enjoy this. I hope you guys check out the site. Again, thank you.
That's it. I hope you guys enjoyed. I'm sorry that Mr. Ramirez didn't show this evening.
Again, Goombas, I know there's a lot of background noise. I'll get this done over with. Goombas, if you like what you listen to, please email us at longcoatmafia@gmail.com and let us know if you like this. If you did, you want to hear more, we'll show up. We'll let Don know that we will show up on the 26th and record this. Hey. We're here for you guys. We're here for the community. Check us out. The rest of our podcast at thelongcoatmafia.podbean.com. Also, we're on Twitter at Longcoat Mafia. And you can follow us also on Instagram at Longcoat Mafia. We do have a Facebook page you could like, which is the Longcoat Mafia Podcast. That's on Facebook. Like us. There's going to be a lot of geeky stuff. If you want to contribute to us, just let us know. Email us. Message us on us on Facebook. The links will be on in the show notes and show description. Like and enjoy.